Okay, our third presentation and discussion this afternoon expands the discussion to include the global networks and audit firm governance. Shortly after arriving at the PCAOB, I was struck by a statement I read by the then head of the International Forum of Audit, Independent Audit Regulators, by Paul Boyle. Discussing the audit regulatory environment, he said, quote, "The first regulatory gap is that the firms which manage the international audit networks are currently not subject to regulation or oversight. As a first step, we should consider improving our knowledge of the structure, operations, and governance of the networks," close quote. Ever since, I have shared Mr. Boyle's concerns about this issue. In light of the fact that the largest public accounting firms, including their foreign affiliates, audit the vast majority of the global market capitalization, the influence over the audit process asserted by those running their international networks is clearly important to the smooth functioning of the world's capital markets. While as regulators representing foreign nations, we certainly have the power and the right to disagree, it would seem that we have the common goal of high-quality audits performed by independent and competent professionals for the benefit of investors. That common goal should allow us to come together to close this regulatory gap and resolve inspection and other issues. Lynn Turner has been leading the working group looking at measures that would provide a minimum level of worldwide audit quality and how regulators across the globe can come together to improve and monitor international firms' governance and performance. With Lynn on the working group are Bonnie Hill and Calvin Blake, who unfortunately can't be here but are represented, Judge Sporkin, Bob Tirola, and Meredith Williams. So, Lynn, with that, why don't you start?
Got a lawyer.
Not bonded, Lynn.
Karaoke. Can we have some music?
That was not the way forward. While we're waiting. We had six in our group, as Steve mentioned. Bonnie, Meredith Williams both had board meetings this week, so unfortunately couldn't join us today. And Calvin Blake had a hearing that he had to be at yesterday, so he's unable to join us as well. But all three of them helped us out with the ideas and contributing to the memo. There is a memo in your materials that provides greater detail and support behind what you're going to turn around and see in the slides. These are global entities, but they're not a single entity. I think this taken from the Deloitte website, and I don't mean to single out Deloitte. You could find the same type of information out at the website of any of the other firms, but it highlights how they are, in fact, independent, separate groups serving the companies they audit in each individual country. And that obviously creates some issues with respect to regulation, with respect to transparency. While they go to market as a single united firm, whenever there's a problem in a firm in one particular country, the firms in the other country seem to not know those guys anymore. It's interesting, over the last few decades, we've found that transparency and governance are key to good corporate results, good corporate performance. We've had an increase, obviously, in the quality of the governance and the independence of the governance at public companies, as well as push for transparency in governments and regulators. We've seen the same with respect to transparency, improved disclosures and all. Each of the large firms, in fact, have their own governance consulting group that goes out and consults with these public companies, discussing how important this governance, the quality of independent governance, the quality of independent oversight, and the importance of transparency is. But yeah, when we turn around and look at these firms, none of them practice what they preach. It's amazing. As we did the ACAP report and took testimony, we found, in fact, that none of the large firms were even providing GAAP basis financial statements to their very own partners. So it raised a question, quite frankly, if you can't get that type of information, how do you know if the firm's even financially stable or not? How can you say litigation will bring you down because no one can get the financial information? And when we, in fact, requested that financial information at ACAP, the firms were unwilling to provide it back to us. In Europe, we're starting to see more transparency because of the Eighth Directive. It's probably best described as a good first step. Wouldn't say it's a lot more than a good first step, but it, when you look at the reports, it is providing additional information. The firms, though, still lack the basic independence governance that most institutions have. The ACAP did recommend the transparency through the annual reports and also recommended improving governance. There was an issue, a debate at ACAP about whether the financial statement part of the report should be public or not. The two co-chairmen supported making them public. Other members, including the accounting firms on the committee, opposed making that information public. They were afraid that it might be used in litigation against them. However, as we've seen from many of the court cases, courts get that information anyway, so regardless of whether it's going to be made public through the PCLB or some other body, if there's litigation involved, people are going to get that information anyway. We did, as a group, support an annual report being filed with the PCLB, just as the ACAP recommended. It's tough to understand, especially given what we've gone through in the last couple of years, all the discussion about systemic risk, and I don't know that I'd put one of these firms in the same category as systemic risk. But quite frankly, if one of these firms were to go down, people are going to come back and ask the PCLB, what'd you know about it? And if you don't even get the financial statements, it's a legitimate question as to how you really are regulating and overseeing. And obviously, as the memo points out, Congress did give you the authority to go get that financial information. We also support the notion of improving the governance, getting some type of governing board on these firms. Richard Breeden supported that as part of SOX. It didn't make it into SOX, but I think the time for that, as ACAP recommended, has come. We also, in the sake of transparency, back to the good steps that Board Member Gelser took in urging Congress to make the whole investigative process public, we do support that. Bringing that out in public, I think one will speed up those investigations, but will have an impact on how these firms operate and behave. Bob Tirolo will come back, and I'll get Bob in a few minutes to expand on that. On the independence of the firms, we talked about the coziness, and we've just been talking about the objectivity. And is it skepticism, or is it just a lack of objectivity? I think quite often it has been just a lack of objectivity. At the end of the day, it isn't skepticism. It's just people really, in their own mind, weren't independent of that management team. We hoped when we passed SOX that we'd get a better result with the audit committee picking these people, but quite frankly, The audit committee financial expert rules got watered way down, and so there hasn't been that much of a change in the audit committees in this regard, so it probably hasn't had the impact. So we have this coziness issue. It was a very key issue to some of the members on our firms. And as we saw from a GAO report a few years back, these firms, and as we heard earlier with B of A and others, these firms, the audit firms, have been with these companies auditing them for a long, long time. 5 years back, you had a large column in that 1 to 2 years because that represented all the changes from Anderson over, about a fifth of them. We did have Big Five, now Big Four, so about a fifth of them did make the change at that point in time. But outside that, you can see some fairly, you know, 3-4 decades of being with that same company. However, after the Anderson thing, we went through a phenomenal change. Over the next 4 years, 6,500 auditor changes, only 2,300 of those from Anderson. People talked about, the GAO did a study at the time, and the GAO went out and surveyed the Big Four accounting firms, and they surveyed CFO saying, would you like to do mandatory rotation? You know, I don't think there was any surprise what the answer was going to come back from that type of survey. In fact, former comptroller GAO said it was one of the worst studies that the GAO ever issued. But it said, you know, with that, we don't want to do it because of the cost. And obviously people think about the cost. And yet, notwithstanding that cost, you had over 4,000 companies on their own decide to make a change in auditor. They decided that the cost wasn't so great that they wouldn't go through it. And we had CFOs going ahead and making the decision to make that change, which indicates that the findings in the GAO report really weren't valid. As a result, and to get to the basic issue, the basic fundamental issue that we continue to have with auditors, and I don't think we'll fix this problem until we are willing to take on this elephant in the room, is to go break that tie between the mindset of the auditor of trying to keep that company and the fees coming in from them, not unlike what we saw with the credit rating agencies, and making a clean break and getting them focused on making sure they get the job done right. And I think to do that, we've got to come back to the issue of mandatory rotation. Will there be costs? There'll be some costs associated with it. But as we've seen, the costs aren't so high that a lot of thousands of companies haven't done it. Do you have the issue of getting smart in the first year that you do an audit and getting up to speed and knowing what you're auditing? Absolutely. No question about that. But we also know from Enron and WorldCom, Adelphia, Tyco, HealthSouth, all these companies that Lehman had auditors on them for decades, and yet despite all that supposed knowledge base from all those decades, they couldn't find multi-billion dollar errors. Or they found them and didn't say anything to the public, which turns around and raises the issue of objectivity again. And I think, as we heard, if we can't get past the objectivity issue with all the digitalization that's going on today, I would predict that in 2 decades out, we're going to see accountants going the same route of journalism, that the digitalization will make them no longer relevant because you'll be able to get the information and enough quality information about the data from databases, run your own models, and we won't need the audit. When we at Glass Lewis could go through those databases and find errors and restatements that the auditors on site couldn't, it gives you an indication that that's the direction that we're heading into. And so now we do start to hear more and more about, is it worth paying, you know, $100-200 million for an audit when in fact we get 4 paragraphs that doesn't give us any information? Can I run the data and the databases, especially with the tagged information, and do that myself now? And I think within the next 2 decades, we'll get to the point that if the auditors can't provide useful information, if they can't really remain objective, then they're going to go the route of journalists. And if you wonder what's going on to journalism, you just have to ask some of the people, like journalists over here. So anyway, strong believers that you need to do mandatory rotation. During that rotation, also make it to where you can't fire the auditor, so we don't get into opinion shopping. I think former SEC Chairman Breeden first suggested that. Put those two together. You'll have to do something in that first year to make sure that people can go through the transition and get up to speed. But I think it can be done. I've never seen an auditor who did an audit in the first year ever issue an audit report that says, I didn't get enough information, I didn't know what I was doing, and I assume in the PCAOB inspections of audits in the first year, you guys never came out and issued a report that said the auditor didn't find enough data or do enough. Certainly, we haven't seen that in the public report, so it doesn't appear to be a problem. On global audit quality, as we talked about earlier, if you look at IBMG and Coca-Cola, they derive a majority of the revenues, and in some cases, a significant majority of the revenues from outside the U.S. And with what we've seen with the problems with the PCAOB being able to get and inspect in countries like in the past, the U.K., France, Germany, Italy, most of the EU, let's be real, China, this has been a problem because, well, people think the PCAOB is ensuring the quality of the audits. The majority of those audits haven't been inspected. So we really don't know whether the quality is good or not. What we do know is we see the reports on China and see some very suspect audits coming out of that particular country. And for those of us who are investing, it is very important that we be able to invest in some of these countries and rely on the numbers. Those countries are having growing GDP. With that growing GDP, there's better opportunities for us to be able to get the rates of return that we need to earn the retirement benefits that people need to have to live in a respectable fashion. So as a result, we need to be able to do that. If, on the other hand, we can't get those returns there, that'll be a problem for us. So global audits are very important to us, but as I mentioned earlier today, the firm still uses the method of what you might call credentialing. They basically rely on that affiliate that is a separate legal entity, unks to itself, as we saw in the first slide, over in that foreign country. The lead partner may go to some of the countries and look at the work, but we're not seeing the type of inspection, the type of probing and supervision that you would see here in the U.S. Some of the PCAOB's own inspection reports highlight that. There's a couple of those inspection reports cited in the memo itself where the PCAOB has found that lack of supervision of international audits. So we do think you need to do something with that, and it's probably going to take a change, a move away from credentialing and to a much stronger standard on supervision. This is one of the example of one of those reports where there were material waived adjustments in a foreign country, and the local U.S. country didn't even auditor didn't even know of it, wasn't even made aware of it. It's amazing. Good inspection report, by the way. We've talked about the same problems with China. So with respect to global audit quality, going back to the first part in the annual report, getting us the information of the quality control, how the firm actually operates, some certifications around that from the executives of the firm, deal with this issue of credentialing and supervision of the foreign audits, and where you cannot get into those countries, China, France, and Germany, and inspect those audits, we'd like to see the audit report flat out come out and state that this portion of the assets and revenues were audited by a firm that hasn't been inspected by the PCAOB. Let the investors know what they're dealing with, what their risks are. Last, some of our members were very keen on improving these audits through forensic audit procedures. This was key to a couple of them. I think it applies both to U.S. and international aspects. This was a recommendation made 10 years ago, 11 years ago, now almost by the what was known as the Panel on Audit Effectiveness or the O'Malley panel. It recommended that we beef it up and start doing a better job. As we know from data that's provided by the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, external audits just don't find it. Yeah, that's all you can say. They just don't find it. And this gets back to the relevance issue. You got only 4.6% of the frauds are identified by external audits. If that's all you're going to find, and you're not going to find the multi-billion dollar errors, why would I want to turn around and pay tens of millions or hundreds of millions in audit fees? It just isn't worth it. And yet what's amazing, most amazing about it, if you look at your own auditing standards, they don't require the auditor to get an understanding about the whistleblower and the tip line, which is the number one way you do find it. And my experience has been on audit committees that the auditors, unfortunately, at times, don't know enough, that sometimes have been literally clueless about what we had or did not have with respect to working whistleblower hotlines. And with us going to Facebook and social media, the hot tips aren't going to be coming in through the company's hotlines, because if you do that, you ostracize yourself and you become very public, might lose your job and certainly can't get the next job. But you certainly can go to WikiLeaks, remain totally confidential. And so we're going to have to deal with this. The world is changing. And that's going to become a bigger and bigger thing. The last thing we want is WikiLeaks finding about these problems and the auditor clueless. And yet the auditors aren't getting their hands around it. It's just an example of one thing that really needs to be taken a look at by the auditors and the auditing process. The O'Malley panel, again, in August of 2000, recommended that there be a forensic type phase of the audit work, that it be embedded in the auditing standards. There were some changes made, but because pushed back by industry, we didn't get the full flavor of what O'Malley was looking for put into the standard. And we think that needs to be beefed up. So with that, I'll turn it over to Bob. Bob can talk a little bit about the
Thanks, Lynn. Bob Tirola speaking. I just want to embellish on a few things that Lynn mentioned. And I'll go back to a statement I made earlier in today about the major auditing firms having a public franchise, yet not having the requirement of public transparency that any public institution has, whether it's a publicly traded company or even a nonprofit enterprise. Institution that has to make information public through various IRS disclosures and otherwise. Yet the profession, the auditing profession, has managed to avoid that. I was part of that auditing profession, and I don't think that's right anymore. There's too much at risk, as mentioned by other task force that worked within our committee to say what Lynn said. If in the event one of the firms is unable to handle its obligations, it would put the board in a very awkward position. I want to talk a bit about the global networks. As a audit committee member of a global company, this has been a struggle. Our two audit committees I serve on both involve global networks, and we relied pretty much on the trust me principle that the U.S. firm will make good on all the work of the international network and take responsibility for it. And in theory, that's the way it's supposed to work, but the legal structure doesn't promote that. In fact, it promotes a segmentation of work liability. And that's bad for directors, and certainly bad for investors. I don't have the answer to that. I don't know how we bridge the legal structure of our global economy to solve that. But for the most part, I would say that audit committees are buying the marketing message more so than the legal fine print, and somehow we have to bridge that gap. Rotation is a an interesting question. I was the CFO of a company who had auditors for over 100 years, same firm. That had some interesting issues associated with it. Boardrooms are private places, and boards would be reluctant to share everything, if you will, outside of that boardroom, nor should they, because some of them should remain private. The investment community, though, needs to know that the relevant information with respect to financial matters is being shared with them, and rotation has a way of promoting that. The privacy of that boardroom changes a bit if there's an understanding that there's going to be a new person there every so often to hear that message, assess the message, and have some obligation to convey that message. And lastly, this issue, the issue of transparency and good governance, I think could go a long way to closing some of the expectation gap. Just by taking away the concern that investors have currently, I think directors also have to some degree, of how these firms actually operate, how they manage their affairs, whether or not they are healthy, can actually back their work with financial resources, and how in fact problems would be resolved among this federation enterprise when they in fact do occur.
I'm here to tell you a good story about an accounting firm with an outstanding fellow heading it, who some 3 years ago allowed me to test a theory that I had. And the theory was the concept of forensic in the audit. We all know that all the accounting firms have good forensic groups, but generally they're being used for people other than their own clients. And my thought was, why don't we use them for the firm's own clients? So along with a former associate of mine, Gene Goldman, and Scott Taub, who was acting chief accountant, we came up with this concept of forensic in the audit. Now, how do you don't have it in every audit, right? So you got to say, how are you going to select which audits you want it in, obvious. And what we did was we would have, at the beginning, risk assessment. We would look at the client. The auditor would look at the client. Where do they do business? What types of risks do they have? Do they do business in areas where they are, where the countries are on the list of Transparency International, of having the possibility of a lot of FCPA and other issues? Once you get to the first issue of the risk assessment, and it's determined that the client is in an area where they have these problems, then what you do is you incorporate the forensic with the financial auditor. Now, why? I mean, why can't the financial auditor do this? Why do you need a forensic? What's the reason for it? Well, the reason is simply the financial auditor is talking about materiality. He's up here. the forensic auditor usually comes in at the low level. He's looking at petty cash. He's going to be looking at things that the financial auditor is not going to look at. And so you have to combine the two together. And the forensic auditor, as he goes into the case, looks and sees if there are agents, looks and sees how they're expensing some of these, how they're treating officials in the countries where the client operates. And so you have this blending and this you have the two working side by side. Now, there are problems there because the financial auditor usually looks down at the forensic auditor, who may not be a CPA. It could be an investigator of some kind. It could be a lawyer even. And so you have to get that blend in and if it works. So rather than just come up with this concept on a theoretical basis with this outstanding leader of this accounting firm, he said, well, let's try it. And so for 3 years now, we've had a test case, and it works. He's come back to say, and we've tested it. I've been there with Gene and Scott. We've tested it for 3 years. It's not perfect. There's still problems, and yet it will work. There's no question. Now, one of the big issues was, who's going to pay for this? You know, is the accountant going to have to – the accountant absorbed it for the test period for the – but what I've learned recently is – you make money because the client needs the assurance that they're not violating the these provisions of the law, the money laundering and the FCPA. So, yes, he's willing to pay that money now so that he doesn't have to go through an investigation, whereas in one case what they had over $1 billion in costs and legal fees. So where it was thought was going to be a problem and getting someone to pay for it is no problem at all. And so the system works, and they'll be testing it, I think, one more time, and hopefully they'll roll it out. But the beauty of it is that that in an era and among a profession where it's always thought that there was a lack of innovation and a willing to be creative, it is tremendous that you find someone now who is willing to try something and doing with the really thinks the concept is good and he's willing to back it. So that's where we are now. Is this going to be should this be the standard? I hope that at some point we'll come to the PCAOB and roll it out. And, you know, I think there should be no reason why we shouldn't meet the expectations of investors. I mean, up until just a short while ago, accounting firms have disowned fraud, have said, we're not interested. We can't find it. We're not going to look for it. I think the profession now realizes they can't get a – that doesn't work anymore, and they've got to do something more. And while this system that we've been perfecting might not be the 100% answer, there are problems of dealing with third parties, of how you're getting access to agents' books and records and things of that kind, but we'll work it out over time. We're going to have to get new kinds of auditing standards to be able to deal with these emerging issues as they arise. But I think you're going to see something that you're going to like, because I think it's really pushing the ball forward, and I think it's going to be a boon to investors.
Steve, let me just follow up with what my two fellow panelists had to say, and maybe come back to the question that Chairman Doty raised at the end of the last session about cost. When you talk about costs, our pension fund saw tens of billions of dollars disappear in value during the Enron scandals, loss on investments. In the last subprime, as I mentioned, we saw $44 billion go down to $26 billion. And Ann mentioned similar type numbers and percentages. In fact, all investors. And that's not to blame the whole thing on the auditors, because that would be sorely misplaced, I think. Ultimately, the people who are doing these bad loans deserve the brunt of the complaint. But nonetheless, the gatekeepers did have a finger in the pie here. And when you look at costs, when you raise the question of cost, I think you need to, rather than start with the cost to a public company, I've never seen investors say we weren't willing to pay the cost to get good, high-quality information with integrity. I've never heard an investor say they weren't willing to pay for that. But what we don't hear in this town, when people start talking about cost, it's always as a vehicle to avoid doing something. It's never people starting off the equation with, what does this cost investors? And I'd urge the PCLB to reverse that paradigm for once and start off with, what was the cost to investors of what we've seen transpire in the last 10, 12 years? And when you look at those numbers and you look at any additional cost to having the auditor go ahead and do the work to provide additional information, and I think most of the information is available, it'll get QC'd to death, but most of that information does exist in those topside memos, quite frankly, and that are required by your own standards. I do agree with Joe on that, but also understand the QCing that will go on. But those costs are but a drop in the bucket to what the 100 million Americans in this country have suffered in losses. They pale by comparison. So that's my view, Jim, on the cost side. On the forensic side, I think Stanley made some very good points. When we came out of Enron, for those of us serving on audit committees at the time, we did see the audit firms starting to put forensic people on every audit, certainly any major significant audit. And that really benefited us in the audit committee in terms of what they could bring, and also their ability to turn around and challenge the auditors to think out of the box. The forensic people do a different audit. They think differently, and I think that out-of-the-box thinking is very important. It was very useful. Unfortunately, what we've seen in recent years as a cost-saving measure, as the firms have turned around and once again started to cut their fees, they've pulled those forensic auditors off of almost all of those audits. Once again, leaving us without the real in-depth type of assessment, expert assessment of fraud risks that you ought to have on the audits. And why was it done? It was done to save cost and keep the partners' draws and salaries up. And I think someone needs to turn around and take a look at why it was that the firm saw it fit to go do it, and I think rightfully so, but then all of a sudden degraded the quality audits around the globe in that respect. On the objectivity issue, probably the best example I can think of involves one of the companies that's been discussed a lot today, AIG. Of course, in 2004, Elliot Spitzer did his investigation of AIG and started to bring his action against them for the transactions that they'd engaged in, including with Jen Rhee. As part of those negotiations and the settlement, Spitzer was very concerned about the objectivity of the auditors. PwC had been their auditor for a long time. And initially, Spitzer wanted them to rotate. The chairman of the board was able to talk him into just letting him go out for a proposal. And they did. They went out for a proposal and brought KPMG and Deloitte and Touche into that process. And in November of 2007, I think I got the right year, they had a bake-off between those three firms. And they decided to keep PwC on. Within days of that announcement, PwC came out and announced that there were problems with the numbers, problems and issues with the company. And court documents have shown PwC was concerned about the valuation models by the time the second quarter Q was being worked on. If there was ever an example of where there was a serious question about the objectivity of the firm that cost investors a lot of money, that cost taxpayers one of the largest bailouts we've ever had, that is it. And if you look at the, you know, $100 to $200 billion that we had to put into that thing, the cost of rotation, the rotating the auditors on that, would have been a drop in the bucket. So small a drop you couldn't even see it compared to what we paid in taxpayer bailouts. So from that perspective, I don't think there's a cost-benefit issue. I think it is very clear. This is an issue of, does this board have the courage to take on what will be a very tough, controversial project, one that we debated in this profession for a good five decades, but we've always danced around it, and as a result of dancing around it, we've never got the basic fundamental issue solved, and I think this is a time that this board can show courage, can show leadership, can show vision, and really separate itself as being a board who did the right thing.
Thanks, Lynn. Mike?
You know, as these meetings go, it's always interesting. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge all the good work that went in by the three working groups. I thought the studies were very thorough. I thought the comments were very good, and I think this is this could lead to what Lynn said. It's an opportunity to really do something significant. One of the things that struck me, though, is that sitting at lunch, you know, the conversation at lunch frequently at these types of gatherings is actually better than the discussion around this table. Fascinating how that happens. And one of the things that came up, this really went to something Barbara said. Barbara said in her report that with Sarbanes-Oxley, we set out to strengthen independence, improve audit quality, and that it appears that we fell short of the mark in that regard. And I thought about that, and what struck me is that we made a mechanical change. It was a good change, one that I support. But what we didn't do is we didn't change behavior that has grown over decades. So what we set out to do, we didn't really accomplish, and that was to change behavior. If you step back and listen to the three reports, I think the thing that has really been discussed is Lynn's elephant in the room, objectivity. I think objectivity goes a long way to strengthening objectivity, goes a long way to addressing many of the problems that we've discussed. And my question, I have two questions for this group. The first question is, do auditors view investors as their clients? And you don't have to answer that, because I think most of you would say no, they don't. Jay Hansen actually alluded to that in his opening remarks. So if that's the case, then how do we change that behavior? How do we change behavior so that we strengthen objectivity? So my second question really is, would this group, this investor advisor group, be supportive of tackling that issue, objectivity, in a meaningful, substantive way, and really looking for, not just taking Lynn's suggestion, but looking at a range of possible solutions. Because one of the things that's interesting about audit quality is it's a little bit like a balloon. Sometimes when you push down over here, it pops up over here. So you have to be really careful about what you change and what levers you pull to make sure that you achieve the intended result without any disastrous, negative, unintended consequences. So the question I have again is would this investor advisory group support really looking, doing what Ann Simpson suggested, taking on a big project and looking at objectivity and how it's strengthened?
I don't think any one individual speaks for the investor advisory group, but we certainly welcome the input of all here. I mean, certainly with respect to myself and speaking for nobody but myself, I would, of course, welcome that. I wouldn't welcome it to the exclusion of other issues that investors have laid out on the table, but I don't see how you can divorce what we're discussing in terms of what I've mentioned, improving auditor objectivity, boosting transparency of auditor skepticism, monitoring conflicts of interest, and policing auditor independence. I think improving auditor objectivity is extraordinarily important. So once again, you asked the question of the investor advisory group. I filibustered, you know, on my personal views on it, giving people the opportunity to think it through. So now it's open season to, you know, whoever would want to answer the question. I don't know, Barbara, you had your tent up. But
yeah, I was going to talk about that anyway, so well played.
I'll take the check after the meeting, Barbara.
That's right. One of the issues that I work on that has nothing to do with auditors is fiduciary duty for brokers. But it's that same issue of objectivity. And I've had occasion as a result to listen to a number of presentations by behavioral economists who basically say, however bad you think conflicts of interest are, however negative you think the effects of conflicts of interest are on behavior, they're much, much worse. You know, you cannot solve the problem of professional skepticism without looking at the issue of objectivity. And, you know, I actually, as I recall, took some heat at the time Sarbanes-Oxley Act was passed for suggesting that it didn't do nearly enough on that issue of independence, that it was, in fact, on that one issue, a fairly modest set of proposals, and that all of the really significant proposals that had been put forward to try and address that issue had, for political reasons, been taken off the table. And so, you know, In an attempt to look objective in presenting my earlier report, I didn't try to presuppose that I know the answers to all of the questions that you might find if you do a study. But I do think a lot of what you find when you get back to, you know, sort of dig in and look at details is that issues around objectivity are going to be at the heart of a lot of the problems that we've seen. And then just briefly on the issue of costs, I sort of have two ways of answering that question. One sounds a lot like Lynn's. You know, $11 trillion in household assets gone in this latest crisis, not all of which, of course, is attributable to the auditors, as Lynn said. But you can afford to pay a fair amount of money in that kind of environment if you deliver significant, meaningful improvements that would reduce those losses. On the other hand, I also, you know, there's a political answer to this question, which is that anything that you propose that raises costs will be opposed on exactly the grounds that you said. You know, you are inhibiting capital formation by making it too expensive for small companies to come to market. The point I would make about that is they're going to say that whatever you do. You know, that is, I mean, I could just put it on a tape. I can't tell you how many times I've heard it. It is used with no factual basis or with the slimmest, most manipulated statistics in order to back it up. And anything you do that looks to force meaningful change and produces business restriction will, you know, resistance will be met with that argument. So you might as well just sort of take it as a given and take it with a grain of salt.
Had yours up, and then I don't know what the order was. So I lost track.
That's fine. I'm always happy to defer to Barbara. On the question that Mike teed up, I think if you can meaningfully improve objectivity, a lot of the other problems in the profession kind of take care of themselves. I think that's a root cause of a lot of other things that we see. So I think to the extent that you can deal with that, it eliminates or at a minimum mitigates a lot of other problems. But the comment I wanted to make is I guess a question to Lynn and his group, and for the benefit of obviously the board and the SEC people. Lynn, one of your recommendations is that there be independent members on firm boards or advisory boards and no less than three. And I certainly support that. But I had a couple of questions for you, and as I said, for the other benefit of the others in the room. To the extent that this is not something that the firms have done voluntarily, there's always the risk that when you impose things on people that they don't want to do, they look for ways to comply with the letter but not the spirit of the law. So some of the things that I guess I would ask is, one, I think to do this well, there would have to be carefully drafted rules that would preclude firms from narrowly tailoring or limiting the mandate. I could create an advisory board with no real power, no real authority. I mean, if you look back to the history of audit committees have existed for long times, and we saw audit committees that never met. We saw audit committees that had one or two people on them, and they weren't independent. And, you know, obviously over time those have become tightened up. But limiting the mandate would be a problem. Putting friends and family on firm advisory boards, and I use those terms broadly when I say friends and family. Some of that is prohibited in the corporate sector, obviously, by SEC rule and stock exchange listing standards. But even with that, we see corporations, because social ties are now outlawed. And so we still see this being an issue. And, you know, obviously the chairman's gone, Jim, but I think one of the things that motivated her proxy access proposal was this very issue. And so to the extent that you're not going to have something comparable for accounting firms because they're private partnerships, I think it's careful. I think it would be important for the board, if they put this in place, that they look to make sure that who are put on those firm advisory boards are, in fact, really independent and not shills. And then the last thing, the Institute of somebody this morning talked about the UK governance code, which is now in effect, and I've talked to some people in the United Kingdom. And the firms are doing it very differently. As I understand it, Ernst & Young now has independent members on the advisory board for the whole global network, is what I've been told. And some others have done it across Europe, and some others have done it country by country. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But I think one of the things that's important there, one of the requirements that these independent firm board members are charged with is being the liaison between the accounting firm and the investor community. And we've talked a lot today about the need for greater involvement of investors with the audit process. So to the extent that the board did something like this in the United States, I think that's a useful feature that we've seen in Europe. So your comments on it, Lynn, would be appreciated.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Joe. I think on this particular board, you've got Chairman Doty, who has been a wonderful counselor to corporates and corporate boards, and I think between Jim and Lou and Dan, they should be able to draft a credible governance policy. Anyway, I hope they would. But I have no doubt they could, and with Jay's help, Jay's been a partner in one of the firms and knows the firms inside and out, and I would think that between those four, they could do an excellent job of crafting something. But I think the points you make, Joe, in fact, every single one of those points you make, perhaps especially the friends and family.
Hey, Lynn, thanks for excluding me.
That was actually intentional, but.
Well, he would be the governance.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, you know, you did the stuff on the audit committees on SOX, so at any rate. But I think Joe's points are all very good points and things people should consider. But I think this board has got the talent to turn around and go accomplish that.
I think that two comments with respect to the cost versus benefit and the capital formation. I think the cost versus benefit argument, as several people have pointed out, have always been used, and they will always be thrown at us. When we talk about accounting standards, we talk about disclosures, everybody talks about how expensive the disclosures are. Then they go ahead and produce those and simply copy them over and over. It's too bad that wherever the central location is where they get that disclosure, they don't have to pay them royalties because all the firms use the same thing over and over. But that's one aspect of it. The other point I wanted to make was about the capital formation issue. That's another red herring that gets thrown at us all the time. I really don't see any empirical evidence, no studies that show me that capital formation has been impeded. In fact, as started this morning, it was pointed out that the first audits were issued in 1897 or something. I don't recall anybody requiring them then. But companies decided that the railroads decided that it would make sense. Railroads decided almost 36 years before the 1933 acts required those audits. Subway systems in New York City were going out and getting audits because they felt that would actually help. They may have been cynical for all I know, but the point is that people went out and got these audits, incurred these costs in order to facilitate rather than impede capital formation. The other point I wanted to make was in response to Mike, as he said, sometimes the conversations during breaks and lunches are quite interesting, or maybe even more so. And I think what we were talking about and what the day has shown me is that this is not a simple, single-directional, unidirectional problem or anything. That's why I said earlier the study that we think you must undertake is something that you will have to plan carefully, and you'll have to keep your eyes open as you go through it because it will suggest directions to go in. But it has to be done with a great deal of care. I think it also has to be done because, as investors, we've paid a lot for this already in terms of losses that have been listed by Barbara and by Lynn, not to mention a whole host of other places and studies that would show you how much it has cost investors. And in fact, the other point is not just the investors. I think the real question is how much has it cost the economy not having a substantive system in place?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, please, at any time,